Session number 11369, Peter Walpole, reel 4 of 5.
Peter Walpole, reel 4.
So in that sense, I think when the time came to go, I remember being initially a bit surprised. I thought, well, surely we could stick it out a bit longer. We're all here fighting. But what I didn't appreciate was how the fire really had taken a good hold inside, and how it was spreading, and people could feel it on the upper deck down below, and that was probably one of the major reasons for going. Added to that, I think Captain Salt was very aware that we were tying up two other escorts who really shouldn't have been looking after a warship. They should have been looking after the aircraft carrier and protecting the main body. So obviously his decision was absolutely right under the circumstances. But I remember feeling regret that we couldn't stay and keep going. But we certainly would have run out of energy pretty soon, I think.
Those 20 casualties you described, it was 20, was it? 20, 22, 20?
I forget the precise number.
The casualties, the dead... would they have been people, you know, hit immediately or trapped down below before the firefighting business started, or would you have lost any during the firefighting?
I don't know that we lost any during the results of the initial impact. I mean, clearly some people were very probably overcome with smoke down below or just couldn't get out of where they were. And I think the facts of history have recorded that for some of them. Certainly, I was unaware at the time how many casualties there were.
And your own condition, you know, I was wondering also, you've explained this great problem that you had to go across the hot area, didn't you, in order to reach a safe place from which to do your great leap. Did you have burns?
No, I think the only mild thing I had was inhalation of smoke, but it was not something that bothered me at all. Later, for instance.
Yeah. Would your gas mask have prevented that, or would you have needed other firefighting?
No, essentially you need more than just a gas mask. The gas mask can help in a very small way to help keep out some of the thicker smoke particles, but obviously the body needs oxygen, and if there's smoke, there's no oxygen, or there's a depletion of oxygen, so it won't give you oxygen when you need it. Although I do have a lasting vision of the quartermaster just before we evacuated the bridge, going back a few hours, just before we left, as the smoke was billowing all around us, that the quartermaster, Steve Yakovu, I have a lasting impression of him sitting at his post in a determined manner with his gas mask on to try and keep out the smoke, and briefing me that he was trying to take control of the steering but was unable to do so, but he stayed at his post in a sort of commendable, forthright manner. I remember that.
Did you not have respirators on the ship, you know, in the right position?
Well, we did, but again, many of them are inside the ship. And I think perhaps one of the lessons from the Falklands has been the beefing up of the amount of firefighting gear that is on the upper deck as opposed to inside. But, I mean, there would in any case not have been enough for everyone, although firefighting gear was flown in at an enormous rate by helicopters as they came to try and come to our assistance. And I remember one large sea king coming and hovering over the forecastle, lowering breathing apparatus and fire pumps to help the fight.
You were saying earlier, you know, that was very comforting, the fact that people were around and helping you in whatever way possible. That was great support, was it, to have that?
Yes, it was. I mean, I think at first, after the attack, it was really the fact that no one else probably knew what had happened to us. And we felt vulnerable, either from re-attack or from because we couldn't maneuver and therefore someone else could come and get us, like any sort of prey trapped. And therefore the sight of a Harrier coming and flying over the top of us was essentially good for morale. I think after that, the word got across to everyone what had happened after the helicopter had been launched and they briefed the flagship. And after that, ships came and provided assistance, and obviously that was all very comforting. And that really is when we just got on with the business of trying to fight the fire in a commendably matter-of-fact sort of way, although I say so myself. Everyone seemed to be very professional, just trying to make the very best of a difficult, difficult situation.
And yet you said earlier there was no panic. You felt there was no panic.
No, everything seemed to... Again, maybe this is a reflection on our training, that we don't panic. I don't know.
The lessons you were saying, you know, with your firefighting, to have more respirators and stuff up on the top of the ship, were there other lessons learned, you know, about materials? All this black smoke, you know, was that due to sort of plastics, certain types of material being used on the ship?
Yes, I mean, I think one of the lessons that probably came from attack on the Sheffield and other ships was the flammability and the type of smoke that was given off by certain products that are fitted to ships these days, or certainly then, that were perhaps not in the experience of people from the last great battle at sea during the Second World War. So yes, there may well have been. And certainly I'm sure changes have taken place in the design of some of the cabling that's used. I know there was a lot of speculation about that, but at the end of the day, you have to remember that a ship is full of flammable materials. Whatever it is, there is stuff, and if you heat it up hot enough, even metal will melt. So there's a lot to burn. I mean, a ship is full of fuel and ammunition to start with, to say nothing of all the other goods.
You explained about, you know, seeing this great wall of flames leaping high into the sky. Did it surprise you, you know, how a ship could catch fire? You know, having been through your training, were you still surprised at how quickly and how deeply it was affected? But was it not one missile?
Yes, it was. It was. I mean, I think the missile went into the sort of engine room type spaces in the centre of the ship, where there is obviously fuel, and I'm sure that contributed to the flame. But in terms of surprise, I suppose that during the training you fight an established fire. You don't actually watch a fire develop and start and go through its various phases. And as I said, there seemed to be this first phase of the fuel and perhaps paintwork that it touched off. And that produced this enormous flame that was quite startling to look at. And you thought, crikey, what's that? But that did subside actually quite quickly. And the fire seemed to get a hold on the inside. And there was less physical evidence of the fire beyond the smoke from the upper deck. These flames were not apparent. I remember looking over the starboard side later, when the smoke was not obscuring the view, and there was just smoke billowing out. So the flames did die down there. It must have been something that the missile caught at the edge of the ship, the fuel or the paint.
You've also explained about your sighting of this little dot, which sort of blossomed into a flower and then started coming towards you looking like a missile. Should you have spotted earlier that it was a missile? You know, has anything been debated on this?
Well, no one's given me a hard time for not spotting it as a missile or recognising it as such. I suppose I can excuse myself on the basis that I'd never never trained to identify a missile coming straight towards me. But I don't see that as something lacking in one's training. I think really, while visual identification is important, perhaps the emphasis previously had been on radar detection of a missile as a missile, on seeing it breaking away from another air contact, moving at speed. Yes, I mean, if I had known that it was a missile through some prior some sort of vision that it was a missile, or something had told me that it was, I may have been able to provide that information earlier, but I think it would have only been seconds earlier than the impact itself. They do move quite quickly.
Some kind of medical treatment on the arrow?
Well, certainly those who needed it were provided with medical treatment, and obviously the medical services throughout were marvellous. I think the only treatment I wanted was after I'd had a shower, to get all the smoke and the smell of smoke out of me and out of my hair. I then had this burning desire to get a Q-tip and clean out my ears. So I went to go and see the medic, and he advised me that I shouldn't really stick Q-tips in my ears, but I did anyway, and managed to pull out a lot of black gunge, which I was quite grateful for. Probably improved my hearing. So, yes, the next thing after that was we clearly had to get off the Arrow and get somewhere else and get out of the hair of the ship's company of the Arrow. And the plan was that we would go to two support ships. One was the Fleet Auxiliary, the Resource, RFA Resource, and the other was the RFA Fort Austin. And I remember there was a long transfer, a series of transfers by helicopter that morning. I must say, I wasn't feeling very good. I can't remember if it was seasickness or what. Or I started to go down with a bit of a flu. But the helicopter came, and the helicopter was far too big for the flight deck and too heavy. And it was an extremely skillful piece of flying. I mean, the ship is not normally cleared to have a Wessex sitting on the back end. But the pilot managed to just touch the wheels down and keep half of the weight on the rotor. And we all scrambled aboard and were taken over to the Resource, where we landed on the back of there, and then were taken away. And myself and a group of others occupied the captain's day cabin on board the Resource, where we spent I think we must have spent about 10 days on there. Here we were looked after and were taken below to pick up our survivor's boxes. And these are boxes, pre-packed boxes of basic clothing, shirt, sweater, pair of gym shoes, and a pair of trousers, and a white towel. And this is your survivor's box. And I remember, ironically, that some few years ago before, when I had served in a training establishment, I put my name down on a list of people looking for a particular type of seaman sweater, because these are very fine seaman sweaters that they... don't make anymore, and they use a natural oiled wool, which is semi rainproof. And they are beautiful sweaters, but while I was serving, I never managed to get one on this sort of return basis of young people who join the Navy, get issued with them, and then have to hand them back if they leave. But lo and behold, I opened my survivor's box, which was packed in 1950-something or other, and thought, good gracious me, here's a seaman sweater, just like the one I've been after. And also a fabulous old pair of plimsolls, pumps, that looked very dated. All sort of slightly brown and smelling of mothballs, but it was lovely to have a clean change of clothing, except for the one thing they didn't pack, which was underclothing. So we had to find a way of devising of washing one's underwear. But it was nice to have a change of clothing. And the food on board the Resource was excellent, and I remember having this attitude that you should eat well, because you didn't know where the next meal was coming from, and if you had to survive a few hours in the water, it was better to have a big meal inside you. So we were all eating like trenchermen on board. And they looked after us very well, and I had tremendous admiration for the crew of a ship like that, because on going down below to the hold to pick up my survivor's box, I was able to see firsthand the incredible amount of ammunition that is on board one of these ships. It was stacked high with torpedoes and bombs and missiles. And clearly they were very vulnerable in that sense. One of the reasons why we guard them so closely with escorting destroyers and frigates. But there was an ancient doctor, RFA doctor, who was in the bar regularly. In fact, in the bar whenever it was open, I should say more correctly. But he had a sort of slightly wry humour on the whole matter. On seeing us with our life jackets, he said, "My dear chap, you don't need a life jacket. If this thing goes up, you will need a parachute to get you back down again." I suppose that really was a little bit of concern, not what he'd said, but conscious that this thing was loaded with ammunition, and that while they had had a chance to get used to the idea, we were clearly more used to ships being hit underneath us. And when we went to air raid warnings and would close up on the deck, I remember I had a keen desire to do something. I wanted to be involved because I felt that above all I was one of the few people that would know what the missile would look like when it was coming towards, and therefore I should be up there pointing it out to people and doing something about it. So I was very pleased when I was given a rifle. I mean, God knows what you could do with a rifle against a missile almost travelling at Mach 1, but it made you feel better, and that was more important. And so I was very happy to load a round up the chamber and stand there looking over the guardrail into the mist of the South Atlantic, expecting to see something coming. On subsequent raids, I found somewhere that was a bit closer and perhaps a bit more useful. I joined a gentleman who had a moustache and rather long hair and a swarthy appearance, who was manning a machine gun post. I assume he was Special Forces, because I remember asking him as I manned this thing. I was there to feed the ammunition into his gun, and I was going to help him and point out, and I briefed him where this thing came from and what the height it was, and you just keep looking out there. And I said, "Have you had many of these air raids while you've been on board here?" And he said in a matter-of-fact way, "I don't know, I've been ashore." It didn't dawn on me at first, but this, of course, was long before the landings of British forces, and this Special Forces man had clearly been wandering around the islands at night trying to find out where the Argies were. But he said it in sort of matter-of-fact sort of way. I thought, what, you've been on a run ashore? You've been drinking in the local pub? Or what on earth do you mean? But it didn't sink in straight away when he said, "Been ashore." So it was nice to be able to do something or feel I could do something, because that was important to us. But then the plan began to emerge as to what was to happen to the crew of the Sheffield, and we were to return to Ascension Island aboard a BP tanker called the British Esk, one of the products tankers that had joined the task force as a fueling ship. So, as I say, I forget how many days we spent on the resource, but eventually we were to be transferred. One of the things that we had been advised to do while we were on the resource was make up a list of items that we had lost on board the ship, and this would enable us to perhaps file some claim in due course. And I have to say, in the whole business of claims, that the Navy was very good, or the Ministry of Defence were extremely solid on the whole business. So it was an interesting exercise to sit down in the captain's cabin of the resource, and I drew little sketches of the cabin, elevations, if you like, side elevations, one from one way, one looking north, one looking south, one looking west, and imagine myself opening each of the drawers and what would be in them, because clearly, having lived in this confined space of the cabin for some 5 months, I had a pretty good idea what was in there. And I still have the list that I forwarded, and it was one of these things that, because I had the time to sit there and think about everything that had happened and everything that we'd done on the deployment, I was able to construct what is probably a very accurate picture of what was in my cabin. It is, after all, a small space, some 6 foot by 4 foot. and make out a big list of everything that was there. I remember going through that list, thinking which are the things I would have liked to have hung on to and which are the ones it really didn't matter and were replaceable. And clearly it is the irreplaceable items that you miss most. The books, although I must say one or two were editions that they don't print these days, they're replaceable. The clothing is essentially replaceable, as were many of the other items. And so I also built mentally a small picture of the things that I wanted to take. If only I'd had the foresight, I probably would have had them stashed in my gas mask case rather than the gas mask. But such is hindsight. But I think the items include recollections of what was happening, which I was writing myself, personal recollection of my own feelings at the time, which clearly would have been invaluable for this sort of thing. And also, I was asked to keep a less formal log by the first lieutenant of ship's attitude to what was going on as well, really just a sort of, as if you like, a news article. Again, for posterity, everyone had a sort of awareness that what we were doing would be interesting to other people in later years. So I was keeping that on behalf of the ship, and a record, my own as well, which must have gone to several hundred pages by the time we got down there. I would have liked to have kept that. I would have liked to have kept the slides of the deployment which I'd taken, and if I'd had my camera with me as well, I could have taken some pictures that would be very memorable to me. So the camera, a couple of boxes of slides, a sketchbook of mine which I'd had on the go for several years and had sketches from holidays in France and sketches around the deployment, just little pen and ink sketches and crayon and pastels. And I would have liked to have hung on to that as it was a personal record of things I'd done. I mean, I remember with a wry smile writing on the claim form, A5 sketchbook cost £1.20 or something, but I mean, it was completely incomparable to the value to me. I lost a small fluffy toy. All sailors have small fluffy toys, I'll have you know. His name was Dormouse, and he shared my bunk. So he was a casualty. I didn't list amongst the others, not wishing to demean the loss of life, but he was a loss to me, I suppose. However, my sister, bless her heart, had a replacement as soon as I got back to UK. So a small fluffy toy was replaced. What others were there? I suppose a couple of small other personal items that I would have liked to have hung on to, but it was just a reflection that the value of those items was incomparable to their financial cost when I put them on the claim form. But essentially, there was very little that I needed and would have liked to have hung on to, as much as the small items I could have stuffed in my haversack. I suppose the letters as well I'd received on the way down there, I think those were of obvious importance to me. So, having completed that list and having moved, we then went over to the British Esk, and this again was another helicopter transfer. And we found ourselves aboard this BP tanker that had a crew of 31, and I seem to remember that with the combined crew of HMS Sheffield, the crew of the tanker, and one or two other people that came with us, including an RAF pilot, Press Association reporter Peter Archer and a few others, that the total was some 311 on board a ship designed to carry 31. So it was actually very cramped aboard there, and I can recall feeling very little sympathy for the Argentinian prisoners of war who were 8 to a four-berth cabin aboard the Canberra on their way back to Buenos Aires. While I was in, I think, the chief engineer's cabin with myself and about 20 other officers. So, little sympathy there. And then the long, slow trog back, which at first did seem full of danger, if only from the fact that we were still within range of air attack, and here we were aboard a tanker, which didn't seem much better than being aboard an ammunition ship. But it was tremendous to be back with the rest of the crew, and we sorted ourselves out very quickly to give ourselves an organisation aboard the ship, of which the most significant thing was eating. because trying to feed 311 people aboard a ship that clearly was not designed to cater for that meant that nearly 24 hours a day people were being fed. So breakfast, we were all issued with different coloured cards, red breakfast, pink breakfast, blue breakfast and green breakfast, and you were allowed a certain time slot to shuffle through. So breakfast started at some ungodly hour, like 5:30 in the morning, and went through till about 10 o'clock, and that saw that lot through. And then the people who'd had breakfast first were then just about coming in for lunch. And then the lunch went through until mid-afternoon, and then by then it was early supper, straight through to the end. So there was this constant feeding, trying to get everyone through. And they did their level best to cater for us. But at first it was very confining because we were all stuck inside the superstructure of the tanker, because in the South Atlantic the weather was really not suitable. But it became much more pleasant when we could, the weather became warmer and we could get out onto the tank deck and move around the upper deck of the tanker. It became far less constraining. But the conditions really were probably more akin to what I'd expect almost in a prisoner of war camp, I think, being confined with so many people inside a small construction, inside just the superstructure at the back end of the tanker. And the food, which they did their very level best to give us something, but the portions were by necessity much smaller than we had had. And I remember returning to UK and having had the flattest stomach I've ever had and ever had since. So clearly I lost weight on the way back.
You know, I was wondering about the after effects, the immediate after effects I'm talking about now. You know, this group of survivors on the ship. Where did you have any? You know, were you? Did you say, you said you had flu, I think, immediately afterwards. But I was wondering if there are any more serious after effects of an event like that that you experienced or that you noted with others.
Well, clearly there are well documented cases of people who were in the Sheffield and have suffered from what is now termed post-traumatic stress syndrome. I think, really just to correct the thing about the flu, I obviously had some sort of fever and high temperature, but now that I remember, because it was related to the helicopter transfer, I remember feeling awful in the helicopter, that in fact it was on my way from the resource to the British Esk, not immediately after the Arrow, so about 10 days after. And I mean, it's quite probable that this was due to stress. I'm sure stress can induce many things, and that the body says, okay, you know, the defences have had enough. Here's a bout of flu, and you're going to have it, so live with it. It lasted a couple of days, and I don't remember much more about it, except after the transfer, I remember lying huddled on the couch of the chief engineer in the British Esk and sort of with that sort of feverish stage where you shake uncontrollably. But it was just a flu.
Would that be a psychological aspect at that stage?
At that stage, I honestly can't pinpoint any, other than the sort of general mood that you would have of obviously the loss of companions and the sadness of that.
Did you lose anyone close to yourself?
No, not as close as my closest chum, so no. I mean, we lost very good friends, and certainly amongst those in the wardroom, both the supply officer, John Whitehead, and the supply officer, Hugh Balfour, and the weapons engineer officer, John Whitehead, who both Al and I knew well. It was obviously a shock to lose them. Tremendous shock. I think more so in the case of John Whitehead because I had met his wife and daughters. They had flown out to Mombasa to join the ship there. So that was the last they had seen of John, which was particularly sad. Obviously, it was tremendously sad for all of them who had lost relatives. I cannot say that at that stage I was feeling or was aware of any psychological effects.
Have you had any since?
I think the one thing I have noticed is that events that recall either heroic deeds or loss of life, I receive them in a more emotional manner. And the classic example, of course, is the Remembrance Day celebrations. Things like hearing the last post tends to be more emotional to me these days. I dare say it's because it has a far greater relevance to me now that I've lost people I know and that I've experienced what was essentially a war. That I've noticed, and in some ways that seems to have been more recently, so in other words after a few years it seems to have come home to roost a bit. And also if I hear of tremendous heroism prior to death, not necessarily in military action, and then the sort of somber commentaries you get at things like Remembrance Day celebrations or even hearing the old buffers talking about Gallipoli or something like that. And I suppose you feel an affinity with them, and when they talk about something that was emotional to them, that it tends to heighten that emotion in you. So that, I think, has probably been